Hey, I'm Jeremy Loeb with BPR News. You're about to hear a conversation with Western Carolina University political science professor Chris Cooper. Also joining me in the studio is BPR's news director, Matt Bush. This conversation took place Tuesday morning, May the 16th of 2017. All right. Well, Chris Cooper, welcome back. A lot to talk about. The Senate has passed each version of the budget.
Yep.
Was there anything that jumped out at you about the Senate budget, or is it kind of more of the same that you expected?
The Senate budget looks about like we expected, right? So there are some things that happened. There was definitely some crazy stuff that happened over the course of passing that budget. But as far as what's in there, look, we're looking at slightly larger tax cuts than Roy Cooper wanted. We're looking at spending that is sort of distributed slightly differently. We're looking at a couple little attacks on higher ed, but nothing major. So I think, yeah, for the most part, the Senate budget looks about like what we would expect an overwhelmingly Republican budget to look like.
Yeah, and talk about some of the craziness. You know, I know that budget ultimately passed after 3 a.m.
Right.
on Friday night.
Right. Yes, yeah, it's crazy, right? So in North Carolina, there's a couple of readings, right? So usually the first reading and the second reading get about the same vote. There's not a lot of action in between them. So what happened was they did the first reading and things seemed okay. They took a vote. They did the second reading of the budget, and then the Democrats started filing some amendments. The Republicans got kind of upset about it, and the Republicans said, hey, wait a second, let's take a break. They took a break for like an hour and a half, and they came back and they introduced a bill that said, hey, we want to stop opioid addiction. But the mechanism to get the money for that was to strip some funding from overwhelmingly Democratic districts, including some of the Democrats that were keeping them up so late at night. So obviously the Republicans have taken some heat on that one.
Yeah. So was that just a retaliation move?
You know, it does seem like it. I mean, I think both parties would agree that opioid addiction is something we need to do something about. As far as how to fund it, though, it's hard to read that as anything other than kind of a slap back at Democrats. Whether that becomes law or not is a different story. I think it probably won't. But I think it was almost like a brushback pitch in baseball.
Yeah. Big news yesterday was that the voter ID law is going to remain on hold, I guess, yeah. Or it's basically shut down at this point.
That's right. So the United States Supreme Court came in and said, hey, we're not going to hear this. And so what that means is that the last court that weighed in, that opinion holds. And that opinion was that our voter ID law, which was really a little bit broader than just voter ID, was unconstitutional because, you know, in the words of the court, it targeted African Americans with almost surgical-like precision. Mm-hmm. The court, though, is pretty clear to say, hey, we're not weighing in on whether we actually think that's true or not. We really can't weigh in at all because it's unclear who's even bringing suit here because we've had so many different folks and so many different parties weighing in on this issue.
Yeah, I think it was McCrory and Republican leaders who initially filed the appeal. And then when Cooper came in and was elected and Josh Stein was elected, they said, you know, we don't want to appeal anymore. So there was just all this confusion there.
Yeah.
I know that Phil Berger and Tim Moore have indicated that they're going to go ahead and try again with maybe some more voter ID legislation. What do you think the chances of that would be?
I think the chances are really high. And I think the odds of passage are very, very high. This law, I mean, we call it the voter ID law, but in some ways, voter ID is the sort of the smallest part of it as far as like raw impact. So I think what we did to early voting has much bigger consequences. The eliminating same-day registration was actually a huge change. And so what I would expect is maybe the Republicans back off on a couple of those, but the voter ID, the kind of headline piece of it, is likely to make it into law again.
And that's kind of similar to when they filed those changes to elections boards. The court struck that down. They went ahead and passed a revised version of that law. Is that something that you've seen over the years?
It is, right? I mean, especially in the last few years. I mean, the Republicans have control over state government in North Carolina, despite having a Democratic governor, right? They have super majority. So they can essentially put something out there. The court knocks it down. That's fine. They take it back. They rewrite it. They then get a bill that will pass through the courts.
Since the Supreme Court won't hear this voter ID law and the Senate and House leadership says they will try to craft another one, what might get passed that is constitutional, and what effect will it have on next year's election, which Democrats see very, very big, or is a very big election for them?
It's a huge election for Democrats, by extension for Republicans, right? So, yeah, I think we're going to see a version of the voter ID law. My guess is it will be more about the ID and less about some of these other provisions. So if I remember right, there were 21 different provisions of that bill. And so some of them that have been the most controversial have been things like reducing same-day registration, taking some swipes at Sunday voting, the so-called Souls to the Polls initiative that's been very successful for the Democratic Party and for the African-American community. And so what I would expect to see is maybe a softening on some of those other issues. But the big headline issue, voter ID, I would imagine the Republicans will push forward and probably be successful in getting that passed.
So the beer bill, the craft beer bill that McGrady had filed, Representative Chuck McGrady from Hendersonville filed that bill got stripped. Now we've seen a lawsuit. It was actually filed by two brewers in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that lawsuit? Do you think that they have a good shot at prevailing?
You know, I think it's possible they do. And I think this is such an interesting political issue, right? So you've got a lot of Democrats that supported this bill, but then you've got this kind of big business, Anheuser-Busch, or InBev, I guess it is, and Miller that are kind of fighting against it. And so it's created some odd partisan alliances, I think. And so I think politically, it's an interesting bill. And I think legally, sure, maybe they do have some chance. At the same time, InBev, as we've seen, even in Asheville over the last few weeks, has a lot of money to spend on this.
And what's interesting, I think, is some of the names that are involved with that. You've got Chuck McGrady, you know, fighting for the craft brewers. You've got Tom Apodaca lobbying for the wholesalers.
Yeah.
And then you've got Bob Orr, former Supreme Court judge, Justice representing the craft brewers in this lawsuit. Three Western Carolina connections right there.
Yeah, that's right. Beer City USA is making its voice heard here on this beer issue in Raleigh.
The power of Anheuser-Busch InBev, which just recently bought a brewery here in Asheville, that they're able to have so much power, and wholesalers and the bottlers and the people who drive the trucks and all that, how are they able to have so much power in a state legislature?
Yeah, I think it's politics 101, right? They have been there making the case, yes, it's money, but it's influence, it's access, and it's information, right? So you become a state legislator, you don't know about every issue in the world, and here you got somebody who does know everything about beer and can make a fairly coherent case that, hey, what we wanted to do is to be able to protect the beer that gets out there. We want to make sure that it's safe. We want to make sure that it's of good quality. And so folks like InBev have been able to lobby successfully and say, we're the people to do that.
But this certainly might explain their power, explain some of the backlash that Wicked Weed in Asheville received, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the Wicked Weed piece has been an interesting national story. So, for example, there was a brewer in Texas that came out, Jester King, and said, look, we like Wicked Weed a lot. These are our friends. But at the same time, we're having a hard time because they've joined hands with forces with InBev, who has lobbied against small brewers. And so I think all of these, this sort of Beer City USA in Asheville actually has a whole lot of political implications. And again, it creates odd bedfellows because you've got small business folks that support the craft brewers coming together with some kind of very free market oriented people. But at the same time, the big beer lobby has been very successful with Republican politicians. So it is a really interesting case that in some ways defies the normal politics of North Carolina or any other state.
Right, because it's the John Locke Foundation that's been very big fighting, and that's a pretty conservative organization that's been fighting for craft brewers and distillers and wineries, right?
That's right. And so their take, they are a free market-oriented think tank, and that is probably an understatement, right? And so their take is, hey, let's let the market work. Let's reduce regulation across the board, whatever that's about. When it benefits Republicans, great. When it benefits Democrats, great. And in this one case, they're saying, hey, this will benefit craft brewers if we just open up the market. So yes, John Locke Foundation's been very vocal about this issue.
The elections watchdog group Democracy NC had also noted the wholesalers have contributed money. That surely, I guess, is playing a role in this as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think there are smart lobbyists on either sides of these issues, right? So the craft brewers have come together and sort of hired their own lobbyists, but it is difficult to compete with the major craft brewers, what used to be called the big three, and it is now sort of the big two.
Yeah. Senator Fletcher Hartzell, I think he's being sentenced today, and he was accused of misappropriating about $200,000 of his campaign. Democracy NC also had some pretty serious allegations about Senator Ralph Heiss up in Spruce Pine. Mm-hmm. How serious do you think that is? I mean, we're talking about what they've sort of nailed down is maybe about $10,000 of unaccounted money, where they are looking at his campaign and say that his forms are sloppy.
Right.
So could be a crime, could not be a crime.
Yeah.
Have you looked into that any?
I have some, and I think it's too early to know whether really it is a crime. But I think one thing it does is it reinforces for the average voter that politics is crooked, right? Whether that's true or not is kind of a different conversation, but I think it will continue to erode people's faith in the system. I think there's a perception that state legislators are lining their pockets. I don't think that's necessarily true. State legislators in North Carolina make $14,000 a year, and I'm actually rounding up. But that perception is out there, and I think that perception will continue with this. Certainly we had, wasn't that many years ago in North Carolina, where we actually had a state legislator taking bribes in the bathroom of an IHOP. So this kind of thing is not new to our state. It's happened before. It's going to happen again.
Senator Richard Burr, whose prominence is really growing, of course, with all these investigations going on into the Trump campaign. A lot of people have been comparing him to Sam Ervin.
Right.
What do you think about that? Do you think there's a comparison to be made?
I mean, it's a fun comparison, right? So, and so if for the less historically minded folks, right, Sam Ervin was from North Carolina, and he was heading up a lot of this Watergate stuff. And so the idea is, if this is like Watergate, then we must see the parallel in the senators who are kind of the voice of the opposition. I think it's probably a little early for that. We're a long ways from impeachment. Impeachment is a political process. It's not really a legal one. So I think it's too early for those comparisons to stick, but it's a kind of a fun game to play.
It seems to me like Senator Burr might be in kind of a lose-lose situation, because if they do investigate thoroughly and find nothing, nobody on the left is going to accept that. That's I don't think.
Yeah.
And it's going to be tainted by politics. So if there's nothing criminal, it seems to me like Burr's legacy, so to speak, stands to take a hit. What do you think?
His legacy, it's hard to know. I think in the short term, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's difficult to figure out what the win is for him, right? So the options are, as you said, he either continues to drive a stake in between him and the Democratic Party, which still has the plurality of voters in the state of North Carolina, or he fights against his own party. Neither one of those is a particularly appealing option for any politician.
Right. Now, he isn't running again,
no,
according to
exactly
him.
Right.
According to him. So he may be freed up, I guess, in some ways.
In some ways, he's kind of the perfect person to do that. He has some respect from both sides. He certainly has power. He has time in office. And he says he's not running again. So he does have some capital to spend. At the same time, nobody likes to be hated by their own party or the other one.
There's been two high-profile resignations on the progressive left, with Chris Scroe stepping down at the end of the month and Reverend Barber stepping down from the NAACP. What kind of impact do you think that will have?
I think it's going to have a big one, right? I mean, if you talk about progressive politics in the state of North Carolina, I think those are probably the first two names that come to mind. So I think there's going to be a little bit of, there is a leadership vacuum developing. And I think what we're all interested in is exactly where does that get filled, by whom? There's no law that says that the NAACP needs to be the head of progressive politics in North Carolina. It's just kind of happened this way recently. So I'm very interested to see if the NAACP can keep its foothold on this sort of mantle of progressivism in North Carolina, or whether another group jumps in.
Barber and Chris Scroe both have, you know, they're moving on to national platforms. So they both say that they're going to still be involved in the struggle here in North Carolina for progressive politics. But obviously, they'll be having their attention diverted to other places, I guess.
They will. They will. And I think it is an interesting point, too, about North Carolina politics and how nationalized it's become, right? So, you know, our bathroom bill has been debated on the pages of every major newspaper in the country. The Republican takeover of the legislature in 2010 was a national story. And I think you can now see that many of our figures politically are becoming national figures.